Welcome to today's Brown Bag Lunch. My name is Joan Packner, and I'm going to be speaking today about two sculptures in Rotterdam, one by Asep Zadkine and the other by Noam Gabo. But we're starting before the sculptures. We're starting with two pictures of Rotterdam. That's Rotterdam before May 14th, 1940 on top. And that's Rotterdam after May 14th. I mean, this is just, you know, what you see here is complete and total destruction from the Nazi bombing of the May 14th date. That bombing destroyed 650 acres, or 60% of the port city. The next day, Holland surrendered to Germany. But honestly, they surrendered, but they never gave in. 1 week later, they started planning to rebuild the city. And the rebuilding by 1949 was really chugging along, and it was essentially finished by 1957. But the rebuilding, of course, changed the character of the city. So what had been a densely populated inner city with houses and labyrinthine alleys, typical of a city that sort of developed organically through the medieval period and up to the 20th century, was reconstructed with broad avenues and open vistas along the model of Paris. So here are our two sculptures. So that's Zadkine's Destroyed City on the left, and Gabo's untitled sculpture, which is common, is the we call the Bayenkorf Department Store Construction, and I'll get around to his nicknames later. But that stands outside, right next to this department store. And these are the works we're talking about. They're separated by a span of 4 years. So the Destroyed City was conceived actually in 46, commissioned in 51, and dedicated in 53. And the other one, which is 85 feet high, the first one is 20 feet high, was actually commissioned in 53 and finally dedicated in 57. Together, these two sculptures are not just monuments, but they're landmarks in the progressive integration of modern sculpture into 20th century culture. They were realized by different routes, and as we'll see later, they meant different things to critics on opposite sides of the 1950s political ideological debates with regard to aesthetics. So we're going to look at the history of each work separately, and then at the very end, we'll fast forward to how they're regarded today, over 50 years later. So these are two pictures of Zadkine on the left, that's him in 1930, on the right, 1965. Just thought you'd like to see what he looks like. He was a Jew, born in Russia in 1890. He moved to London in 1906. He settled in Paris in 1909, meaning before World War I, and always considered the French capital his adopted home. He lived in the U.S., however, from 1941 to 45, but when the war was over, he returned to Paris. So he goes back to Paris, and he's going to visit some friends on the border of Holland and Germany. He's taking a train, and on the train, this is essentially what he saw when the train stopped in Rotterdam. He was stunned. He saw this annihilated city, which he later remembered as a vast desert. And I'm showing this picture because it's before the cleanup. It really was in the wake of the bombing. When he arrived at his destination, it turned out he didn't realize this. It was some sort of a family reunion, and he heard stories about the war from survivors of the conflict that he had escaped. Of course, he felt really guilty. He felt bad. And they magnified his response to the destruction that he had just seen. So he went back to Paris and immediately made a 2-foot-high clay figure with distorted anatomy and a cut-out heart as his analogy for the destruction of Rotterdam, as well as other cities like Le Havre that he had just seen. So that figure we're not seeing, although it was exhibited in both Berlin and Munich, we're not seeing it because it was destroyed in transit. But he had hoped that one of the cities in Germany would commission this inspired work as a monument, but nobody took the bait. So he made a second model. And that's what you see, the plaster with the artist right there. On the right and on the left, you see the cast bronze. That one was 4 feet high, which was apparently twice as high as the original. So cast in bronze, it was exhibited in Rotterdam in the show of his work, and some citizens from Rotterdam came to Amsterdam. They traveled and they saw the sculpture and they really loved it. One of the people who came was the head of the Bijenkorf department store. His name is Van de Waal. So Van de Waal really wanted to see the Zadkine emerge as a memorial to the war in Rotterdam. So what happened was the next year, the sculpture was included in a Rotterdam exhibit of Zadkine's and figured very prominently. At that time, Van de Waal made the official offer to the city leaders that saying he would finance the sculpture. But he did so anonymously. In fact, not only was he a wealthy businessman and modern art collector, not only was he the director of the department store, but the firm, in fact, was owned by, this was a Jewish family. And they survived the war, the business survived the war, and they wanted to honor their Christian friends and faithful employees. So he paid for the whole thing. But nobody really knew this until much, much later, like maybe about 10 or 15 years ago. A combination of cubist faceting and expressionist distortion contributes to the work's impact, the extreme horror. But it's interesting when you look at it side by side with the Guernica, you see that the outstretched arms recall the central figure in Picasso's Guernica painting, which of course Zadkine and everyone knew well by this time. But how about that hole? It's kind of interesting. If you compare it, say, to a Henry Moore, who had been piercing the volume of sculpture since the 30s, and many other artists, what's different is that Zadkine's figure doesn't just have a hole, it's not just a transparency, it's actually maimed. He said that this is a visual, it's not just a visual allegory of the raised city, you put it where the heart of the city had been. So it has a meaning that exceeds its formal characteristic. And no one else seemed to have done this as poignantly as Zadkine. And then we can even look at that base. Rising from the base alongside the figure is a broken and dead tree stump. It's a classical symbol of destruction, ironically providing physical support for the modern tortured figure. So such contrast to the calm we associate with the Greco-Roman legacy. But back to our model. Is this the statue the citizens wanted? It's a civic event, so they have to answer to the people. And there was a lot of debate. This was not an idealized figure. It wasn't a god. There was no victorious hero. In fact, it was intended to be commensurate with the horror of the event. Some people felt it was ugly and depressing. It was too focused on pain. But others felt that it was just the right image for the right moment. And it was commissioned. And I have this little video here of the dedication, which I thought you'd like to see.
Bij de Leuvensluis in Rotterdam heeft het reeds beroemd geworden monument voor een verwoeste stad van de Franse beeldhouwer Ossip Zadkine een plaats gekregen. Deze dagen werd het beeld in aanwezigheid van tal van autoriteiten onthuld door de echtgenote van de burgemeester van de Maastad, mevrouw Van Walsen. Het ruim 4 meter hoge beeld en de sokkel zijn door onbekenden aan de stad ten geschenke gegeven. Het beeld symboliseert de verwoesting van Rotterdam in de meidagen van 1940. De schepper van dit gedurfde monument...
I can't understand Dutch either, doesn't it?
Het is een achteroverhellende figuur waaruit het hart is weggerukt. Zoals op die verschrikkelijke meidag letterlijk het hart uit de Maastad werd weggerukt. Het centrum van Rotterdam werd vernield door een even wreed als zinloos bombardement. Voor een belangrijk deel is de stad nu alweer hersteld. Maar het monumentale bronzen beeld van Zadkine zal de herinnering levend houden aan de zware slag die Rotterdam trof en ook aan de onverzettelijke levenskracht van zijn bevolking.
Yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. So that's the work was dedicated. That was the dedication we just saw, 13 days almost to the day after the bombing. And interestingly, they gave Zadkine the opportunity to choose the site. So he actually chose the northern end of the port where the work still stands today. So let's give this a little context. The image of a physically damaged but surviving figure was a noteworthy international post-war phenomenon, especially in Europe. And it was acknowledged as an appropriate human response to the recent suffering. And there's a long list of sculptors, especially in Europe, who seem to specialize in expressively distorted figures. There's England, France, Italy, even America. I'm showing you a sculpture by Germain Richier. But the destroyed city is distinguished because it was the only one that was built as a public monument. The style that had recently been banned and vilified by the Nazis, Expressionism, now stood as a symbol of survival in the middle of an urban center, not safely tucked into a museum or gallery. Now, Zadkine's destroyed city is a uniquely public image of suffering, misery, grief, and loss. And we don't really have a parallel in America. I was trying to think, even today, do we have anything? And the answer, I was trying to find some Civil War memorials. But there really is nothing that matches that complete destruction that the Europeans experienced. The most striking contrast, however, is the image of fortitude of the soldiers at the Iwo Jima Monument. How many memorials were dedicated here to soldiers whose lives were lost in battle? Countless. But we didn't have entire cities destroyed. The level of collective anguish couldn't be the same. Even now, ideological battles between the representation and abstraction still rage right here. We're looking at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial on top. You see Maya Lin's design, as well as the Frederick Hart Memorial that the veterans insisted on. And it's appropriate because tomorrow is Veterans Day. And on the bottom is a model of the 9/11 Memorial. That's a whole other subject in and of itself. But you can see how the Zadkine fits into that. But now we're going to change over to discuss the Gabo. By 1953, when the Zadkine was dedicated, the rebuilding was well underway. A central part of the reconstruction was centered on widening the Kuhl Single. This is the Kuhl Single, a main commercial artery that used to be a canal. But the city planners at this point decided to straighten the avenue and transform it into the first pedestrian shopping district that's fully integrated into a city. So that's a big deal. The crowning and final element was going to be the new Bayernkorf department store. There was an old Bayernkorf, or old new, there it is. The old store was designed in 1930 by a Dutch architect named William Dudok. It was at the southern end, the opposite end of the same street towards the harbor. When the building was opened, it was acclaimed for its modern design, especially because it had a facade with continuous glass windows that allowed lots of natural light into the store. So you can see that the new building that was designed by Marcel Breuer is quite the opposite. The store was damaged but not obliterated in 1940, so it actually survived the bombing but not the replanning. And the reason is the store owners were offered a coveted new spot at the beginning of the Kuhl Single, so how could they resist? So what did they do? They wanted a new state-of-the-art store. They go to Marcel Breuer, famous architect, they get what they want. The exterior is sheathed in travertine, and on two sides it has a honeycomb design which matches the name of the department store, Bayernkorf, which apparently means beehive. Then they ran into a little bit of a problem. There was a building on the next corner, the Brick Atlanta Hotel. And it was one of only three buildings on the Kuhl Single that had survived the bombing. and they were touchstones for the reconstruction. The problem was, Breuer designed his building, but it didn't come out far enough to match where the Atlanta Hotel, which was fully on the corner. So the town planner said, you have to match the sight line, has to be the same as the Atlanta Hotel. What do they do? Well, they told Breuer, you can add a section of store and bring that out to the edge, if you want, of the street. That would work. And Breuer said, I don't think so. So what do? They need something there so that you have this unified vision. That was important to them. Aha, a sculpture. But what sculpture? Well, you don't want something that's going to interfere or vie for attention with this big building they just made. So someone had the idea of, let's call Gabo. What a great idea. Why not Henry Moore, Reg Butler, or someone Dutch? No, Gabo was actually known for creating sculptures without traditional mass and volume. But who was Gabo? Like Zadkin, he too was a Russian Jew. And as I said, his art was based on the idea that you can create space without mass. Very, very radical. He initially studied science and medicine in Munich from 1910 to 12, and then moved on to philosophy and art history. During World War I, he lived in Norway. His original last name was Pevsner, and he had a brother, Antoine Pevsner, also very well known, but he decided to take the name Gabo, and I don't know if that was his mother's name, and I realize I'm not sure where the actual name Gabo came from, but he wanted to separate his identity from that of his brother, which I think is always an interesting issue. Together, they returned to Russia in 1917, being attracted by the revolution. In 1920, the same year as he made Column, this work, Gabo published the Realistic Manifesto, where he rejected Cubism and Futurism and pushed for a public art and for the independence of art in general. He also advocated the use of new materials, like the plastics you see here. But by 1922, the revolution was history, and he left for Berlin, where he stayed for 10 years. In 1932, he and his brother had to leave Germany because of the Nazi rise. They went to Paris, and by 1936, they were in London, where they hooked up with Herbert Reed and Ben Nicholson, Barbara Hepworth, and a group of artists. He met a chemist, learned about all new materials. During the war, he lives in Cornwall. And by 1946, he emigrates to the United States. He makes the United States his home until 1977 when he dies, and he lives mostly in Connecticut. So that's his condensed version. We're looking at two works here. The one on the left is actually Gabo's, and this is by an Englishman named Reg Butler. And both of these were their submissions to an international competition to honor the unknown political prisoner. Reg Butler was actually awarded the big prize, and Gabo was one of a number of runner-ups, and he was not happy about that. He was really thrilled about the Bayenkorf commission because he felt he was overlooked, and he was, quite frankly, desperate for recognition. The judges felt that his unknown political prisoner submission was too abstract. As a matter of fact, most of the entries, many people thought, were too abstract. An abstraction, sort of to them, was begging the issue, that they were shapes without meaning, was one of the accusations. Gabo felt figuration was regressive, prone to sentimentality and cliché. He could only express himself meaningfully through abstraction. So this is the first proposal. It's a bas-relief. It was what he was asked to provide, but it was actually rejected because it didn't fill the space that the town planners insisted on. So he's caught between the Bayenkorf people and the town people right now. But they said, okay, go back to the drawing board and come up with something else. And so we have the unknown political prisoner maquette and the Bayenkorf maquette on the right. In November 1954, he created a design for a freestanding sculpture to be set several yards away from the building, and he comes up with something clearly derived from the unknown political prisoner. At the same time, he has a new development in his work, which is much more organic, and this is his from 52 to 53. It's called Construction in Space, number 3 with red. But this one is by Barbara Hepworth from 56, and this is Lynn Chadwick, 53. Both of them seem to share that basic structure of the gabo, of something, you got in, something inside, something that's both solid and has transparency, something you can look around, something that has a, like the Chadwick has this crystalline interior. It's not unusual. Gabo was a very, very influential artist at this time. And these also represent an attempt to move away from the expressive distortions that we had looked at just a moment ago. This is the work on its way to being installed. I just love this photo. And here is the work as it was actually installed. And you can, in the next picture, you can see here's the hotel. Sometimes you see the sculpture head on, and sometimes, perhaps most often, you see it from a worm's eye perspective because it's 85 feet tall and we're all the way down there and it goes all the way up there. The truth is, when it's viewed from below, it's curvaceous and interesting but confusing. So I gotta tell you, it's important to gabo that you know, oops, that the work is based on the image of a tree complete with trunk, roots, and branches. It's more architectonic than organic in feeling, however, and the tree, I think, is almost impossible for you to see if I don't tell you about it. So now you might like to know it. The work has various nicknames: the thing, the banana, the gold tower, the flower, and finally the spaceship. I don't know if you feel any of those describe it, but that tells you how people regard it. Gabo said, "I've tried to express the indomitable spirit of the people of Rotterdam and the miracle of a modern city rising from the rubble." So the tree, as well as the abstraction, hopefully symbolized society's survival and regeneration. So here's another interesting view. It's a huge freestanding structure, as tall as an 8-story building, and it certainly does not overwhelm its site. If anything, the site overwhelms it. Yet it's an integral part of the fabric of the city. It evokes the city's past, it exists in the present, and it pointed to its future. In this sense, the Bijenkorf building, considered as a unit with Gabo's construction, anticipates contemporary schemes by architects like Peter Eisenman that use new structures to evoke earlier histories of a site, or more to the point, like Richard Serra, who refers to the fabric of the urban environment in the very siting of his work. Now, since its dedication, it's been an issue of debate. Whether it's in 1960 or 1990, there are a lot of people who feel constructivism failed, and this sculpture failed. But some people, like Herbert Reed, said it succeeds as an affirmative vision, that it's more like an aspirational structure of a Gothic cathedral. Or do you feel like John Berger, that it's essentially decorative, it's just a gimmick to help the department store in its capitalist mission, selling clothes? Well, Berger, who is the leftist critic in this regard, said the universal claims of abstraction were ridiculous, and the problem with Gabo was that he left Russia in the first place, that theories which were alive became static. Benjamin Buklow, a contemporary historian, basically agrees, but he says the problem was that Gabo progressively withdrew from the original constructivist ideals, which is sort of something that happens often to people who start out very radical in their youth. They have to adapt as they get older if they want to implement things. And there is an element of just real gritty life in the truth that if you want a sculpture to be realized, and you have to deal with town planners, you have to deal with a lot of people. It's a collaborative issue. You have to give in. So he perhaps did make certain compromises, but he did get his structure built. Gabo said, "My only dream was to be free of a marketplace." But his work was inevitably constricted by the system that enabled it to exist. So you might see programmatic falsification. Someone else might see necessary compromise and logistical adjustments. The Gabo sculpture is an earnest attempt by an artist to create a public monumental statement about constructivism in these years. The work did in fact resuscitate his career. It put him on the post-war map of the art world, was featured immediately in surveys of European art, even in Time magazine, who called it an ambitious and successful combination of modern sculpture and architecture. So now let's fast forward. We're looking at pictures from 2007. Well, it's pretty obvious that somebody is celebrating the Zadkine. You often find these very romantic pictures. It's at sunset. This one, the sun is shining through the hole. And on the right was actually a memorial celebration of the Blitz with fireworks raining down on the city from 2007. In anticipation of this event, the Zadkine was thoroughly cleaned, reinstalled, and given the full grand treatment. It's lit up at night now. You can find lots of pictures posted on the internet of people who see it at night. A high drama of the work itself is only added to by the theatricality of the current installation. And Berger, who had disagreed with the Gabo monument, loved the destroyed city. He called it an artistic tour de force and the best modern war monument in Europe because it does not try to turn defeat into victory, and nor does it hide the truth by invoking honor. Zadkine's work was public in the true sense. It was about a single subject, a shared catastrophic event that was recognized and understood by everyone. Ultimately, in fact, the statue has endured, as you see, as a landmark for Rotterdam, an eternal reminder of the horror and a testimony to the citizens' ability to rebuild from the ashes of war. It's maintained its vigorous sense of horror and survival, and with the passage of time, it actually has only increased its stature among the post-war European urban memorials. The differences between the two sculptures here extend beyond a simple matter of style to the very different way in which each work was commissioned and ultimately to the distinct place physically and ideologically each work has within the urban environment. The transition in those mere 4 years was a passage from a time when public sculpture was assumed to be a recognizable image about a culturally shared event to a new era when monumentally scaled sculptures in public places were not necessarily monuments in the traditional sense at all. And these works, moreover, highlight changes in a public role for modern art, especially the difficulties in reconciling a public need to commemorate important historical events in a manner that's meaningful with the abstract nature of much art produced since the end of World War II. And if you walk around the city now, I guess the question I ask is, do you find the abstract works that are sort of dotted around the city more distant from you or the historical ones? I often find the historical ones seem more bizarre because I haven't the slightest idea who's being commemorated, whereas the abstract ones often have a relationship to their site, or they're ironically, to me, more accessible, although a lot of people don't share my opinion. So here we are, and these separate sculptures still inflame the passions of those who live in Rotterdam. Zadkine's sculpture was the first one. We know this. It's gotten the heroic treatment, but what's happened to the Gabo? It's a long story and has an interesting coda that's going on literally right now. When somebody from Rotterdam saw that I was giving this talk, they contacted me because they are desperately trying to have the sculpture cleaned and conserved. The city of Rotterdam won't take possession of the sculpture. Why? Because it costs too much to clean it. It looks like a tree, and we may not see it looks like a tree, but it is swarmed by birds. It is covered with bird crap. All those little things, that each one has to be cleaned, and they were all dipped in bronze. It's really expensive to conserve, something nobody thought of all those many years ago. In fact, in 1960, during the process of restoration, it caught on fire. When it was covered with scaffolding, it burned for 10 minutes, and the cost of restoring it, which they eventually did, cost more than it originally did to make it. Now, years of neglect have left this sculpture in very poor condition, and urban development has also lessened the visual impact on the fabric of the city. I had a woman here the other day who told me she lived in Rotterdam for 5 years and she never once saw the sculpture, and she must have walked by it 100 times. Most recently, a proposal was put forth to design a monument for guest workers in Rotterdam that incorporates the Gabo sculpture. The artist, whose name I won't bother you with because you're not gonna remember it, but he wants to have guest workers restore the Gabo and incorporate it into a new monument that he calls a national monument to the guest worker. So, because he felt that nobody pays attention to the Gabo, and let's revive it in the context of what's really important, the relationship between native people who live there and who really, you know, questions about capitalism and labor. So the future of Zadkine's destroyed city does seem secure, but the same cannot be said of the Gabo. So stay tuned, and thank you very much. Questions? Yes?
Other sculptures in Rotterdam, are they more of the figurative type, or have they embraced the sculptures of the
a really interesting question about, because in I was asked about what are the other sculptures that are in fact in Rotterdam, and there is a huge number, like maybe 50, and they're owned or administrated through a central office, and they're a mix is the answer. Some are figural and some are abstract. Yes?
What is the concept of constructivism, and how did the Gabo diverge from that concept?
One of the central tenets of constructivism is to make sculpture that doesn't look massive, because traditional sculpture is figural. Especially think back to 1920 and to the context. Traditional sculpture is figurative. So he wanted, and even with figurative sculpture, he wanted to make work that was affected by the space around it, so that it looked like it wasn't sculpture in the round anymore. He might make a relief. Let's see if I can see, would this start again? I want to just get back. You see that head in the corner? That was one of his early works. And that's, even though it's a head, it's made out of planes. And you have the suggestion of space without actually the volume of space. And on the right, the architectonic idea of making a tower, but a tower that's transparent. That was a dream of working with materials that gave you the illusion of lightness. And something that is transparent is new. It's made with plastics and glass and developed in ways that interact with the space around it and is a much more aspirational vision. Now, one of the complaints was that Gabo sculpture had a base. And a base is a traditional A traditional way of, just like a frame separates a painting from the world around it, a base separates a sculpture from the world around it and signals to the viewer that I am a work of art. But one of the revolutionary tenets of constructivism did away with bases. That one's hanging, the head is on the wall. The image of the column just really sits on the ground on a circular platform in this case. But if you take away the base, then a sculpture inhabits the space with you. It doesn't inhabit a different world. And in that way, the arts and the real world become more intermingled. I hope that helps. Yes?
You said that the Gabo was not a public structure. Who owned it?
The Bayernkorf.
Okay.
I think I might have forgotten to say that the Bayernkorf people, the very same people who paid for the Zadkine, paid for the Gabo.
Okay. But wouldn't they in turn want to maintain it?
It's too expensive for them. Nobody, they're just passing the buck. Everyone feels it's too expensive. So as a result, I'm actually meeting with these people early next month, together with a conservator.
Now, you were going to tell us what the people's reactions were. The people of Rotterdam all negative toward the sculpture now?
No, I think, I don't, they're not negative. From what I can tell, they're kind of neutral. I don't know that they think about it very much because the base is kind of high. And I originally saw the sculpture when I went to Rotterdam, and my experience of it was more like the picture with the bikes, where you almost don't even notice it. You know, there's a lot happening at the street level. And if you walk down Madison Avenue, do you look up and see the architecture of the building? Not really. You just look at the shop windows.
And yet from the pictures, it complements the Broye so well.
It does in its design. But the design in the urban fabric, I think actually the urban setting has kind of worked against it. I don't know that from what I hear, I'm sure people would say they like it fine, but the Zadkine is the one they have the deep emotional attachment to. This one is just sort of there. They might be upset if it went away. It belongs there. You can't move it to another place, like a Richard Serra, you can't move to another place because it derives its meaning and it from this specific site. Yes?
If they have the workers redo or clean this, and it's redone for them, what's thought about in terms of keeping it from getting dirty again? I mean,
well, it's always going to get dirty again.
They're not going to encase it in anything?
No, that couldn't happen. And, you know, that is a part of any public sculpture. I used to work for the Storm King Art Center, and restoration is a huge issue. And there are certain works they wouldn't accept even as a donation because they knew that the ongoing cost would be too great.
But it's just that, I mean, it's
they didn't think about that in 1950. That's correct. Oh, the other thing, by the way, you were asking what did they feel was a retreat from the constructivist ideals, was there's bronze color. It's not actually solid bronze, it's actually steel dipped in bronze. But bronze, being such a traditional material, was seen as something heretical, even though it really wasn't. And also there was question about whether the mesh was structural or just decorative. And so some people felt it's only legitimate if it's structural. Yes.
By structural, do you mean that it's necessary for the...
For the work to stand
to
up.
Stand.
That's
so
right.
Anything beyond that is...
Correct.
Is
deemed decorative.
Is considered a bad word.
Correct. Yes.
Along with this woman's question and statement, have they been considering what to do about the bird situation? Tackle it from that end?
You know what? I can't answer that question.
No. shoot the birds. I mean, they deal with that at airports and, you know,
right, it's true.
Concern.
Uh-huh. It's true. Yes.
Are there works by either of these sculptors here in the United States and any in this?
Well, there's we own Gabo's right here at the museum, but nothing's on, I don't think anything's on view right now.
It's not in the sculpture garden, is
it? No, we don't have anything large. He didn't make that many large-scale works. We actually own that head. We have that head, but it hasn't been on view for quite a long time. His early works especially have a tendency to yellow. The plastics got very yellow, typical of early plastics. So that column I showed you, that was a recreation of an original column. I had the picture of the original column, and it was so yellow I didn't even want to show it to you. Because you wouldn't get the meaning.
Yeah. What are his dates?
Gabo died in 1977, and I think he was born in 1890.
Did he continue working throughout his whole life?
He continued working throughout his life. He dies, I think, in Waterbury, Connecticut. There are a number of papers on repository at Yale. And there's also a huge amount of archival work at the Tate Gallery in London. Yeah.
Have the Bibles been subject to change? Where they, even though I understand it's a site-specific sculpture, but if the Bibles change, the department store might be willing to part with it.
No, you don't want the department store to part with it. It can't be moved. If you had it in the middle of a park, it would just be a big structure. It would have no meaning. The meaning only exists in relationship to the site. Yeah.
The Zodkin, the angularity of the body parts,
mm-hmm,
on that, it's sort of reminds me, and I could be wrong, sort of like Lipschitz sculpture. Were,
yes, Lipschitz. Yes, they were absolute contemporaries. Any sort of part of that school of Paris, Duchamp-Villon, Lipschitz, even Juan Gris, he comes out of that tradition. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, it was typically cubistic.
Yes. It's sort of an expressionist offshoot of cubism. So he uses cubist faceting and expressionist distortion,
yeah,
to create something that's quite obviously has an emotional content.
Arkhipenko,
absolutely, he's right in that mix. Completely correct. And interesting, Arkhipenko also came and settled in the United States. So there's a funny thing, because Breuer's living in the United States. They had all lived in the U.S., and when Gabo actually got this commission, I'm struck by the fact that he was living here, because he moved here in 1946. And Breuer was here. He was at Harvard. Yes?
So he must have had to go over there to do it, though.
He did. He did. And he very closely supervised the construction of the work. The construction of that work was actually done in Rotterdam. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.